It is Wednesday, October 10th, 2007. Sam Cedar sitting in for Mike Malloy on NoVam Radio. Streaming live at NoVamRadio.com. We're blogging. The Sammy Cam is up at SamCedarShow.com. 5 years to the day, the five-year anniversary of the vote to authorize the war in Iraq. Remember, folks, this thing was conditioned on George Bush going to the United Nations and allowing weapons inspectors to actually have an opportunity to investigate the situation on the ground. It ultimately did end up forcing George Bush to allow UN weapons inspectors on the ground, but you'll remember they came back, they said, we found nothing, give us more time, we can confirm this. George Bush said, absolutely not, get out, because we're going to start bombing. Meanwhile, nobody believes George Bush when it comes to torture. I know this is going to come to you as a shock, folks, but according to Rasmussen Musen polls, 42% of the country, that is a plurality, I guess, because 30% believe him, 42% believe that he's lying, that in fact their country does torture people now. Now, if 42% of the American public believe that, is there any chance whatsoever that the percentage of everyone else in the world isn't somewhere around 80 to 95%? Maybe 100%. I don't know. Sad day for America. And the UAW struck Chrysler this morning, and by the end of the day, they had won their strike. Details have not been released, but they are back at the negotiation table, and they've basically cut a deal at this point. So kudos to the UAW. And apparently, what are we now, 2 days away from the announcement of the Nobel Prize on in Oslo on Friday? A lot of people hoping that Al Gore wins, particularly people who want to see him jump into the presidential race. And apparently DraftGore.com is 800 signatures away from hitting 150,000 signatures. That is pretty astonishing. 800 signatures away. I don't know why everybody listening to this wouldn't just go over there just to put it over 150,000. DraftGore.com. Lauren will put a link up on our blog at SamCedarShow.com. DraftGore.com. And new... apparently, I'm just shocked about this, but apparently the Republicans are completely out of touch when it comes to the state of our economy. You'll remember it was less than, well, I guess it was technically more than 24 hours ago, because they first taped this Republican presidential debate at 4 p.m. yesterday. But here is the dud. Fred Thompson saying that the problem with the American public is they don't know how great the economy is. It's the greatest story never told. This is number 10.
I think there is no reason to believe that we're headed for a recession. We're enjoying 22 quarters of successive economic growth that started 2001 and then further in 2003 with the tax cuts that we put in place. We're enjoying low inflation. We're enjoying low unemployment. The stock market seems to be doing pretty well. I see no reason to believe we're headed for an economic downturn.
Right. Senator, you painted a very nice picture. The Dow and the S&P 500 today at new highs tonight, record numbers. And yet, two-thirds of the people surveyed said we are either in a recession or headed for one. Why the angst?
Well, I think there are pockets in the economy, certainly, that are having difficulty. I think there's certainly those in Michigan that are having difficulty. I think you always find that in a vibrant, dynamic economy. I think that not enough has been done to tell what some call the greatest story never told, and that is that we are enjoying a period of growth right now, and we should acknowledge what got us there and continue those same policies on into the future.
That's the problem, folks. The media isn't telling you that the economy's going gangbusters enough. You people are idiots. A new poll just came out today. The percentage of Americans who say that the economy is the major problem facing the U.S. is now at 15%. That's more than double than it was just 6 months ago. 22% of those with a high school education or less name the economy as the country's worst problem. 8% with college degrees. And apparently foreign affairs, that would include our problems in Iraq, was named by 42% of Americans as the major problem. But according to Fred Thompson, it's just because you people are idiots. You're idiots. You don't get it. We got more quotes from John McCain claiming again that, listen, the economy's going gangbusters. Almost 50,000 people are now worth selling things on eBay. 50,000. How many people are in the this country again? Is it millions? I think it's in the millions. In fact, I think it's in the hundreds of millions. Yeah, I'm convinced of it. But 50,000 people are selling stuff on eBay. So it's the greatest story never told. Oh, man. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Raed Jarar and Joshua Holland. They got a great piece on Alternet. Only a U.S. withdrawal will stop Al-Qaeda in Iraq. We'll talk to him right after this. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy, 800-989-1480. We are back. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy, NOVAM Radio. On the phone, Raed Jarar is Iraq consultant to the American Friends Service Committee and proprietor of the blog Raed in the Middle. Joshua Holland is an editor and senior writer for the online magazine Alternet. He blogs at The Smirking Chimp. They co-authored a piece for Alternet entitled Only a U.S. Withdrawal Will Stop Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Raed, let's start with you. Haven't we been led to believe that we need to stay in Iraq? One of the myriad of reasons that we are given and the evolving reasons is because that's where the central front on the war against terror, against Al-Qaeda, is located. And we're doing everything we can to beat them over there so we don't have to fight them here.
Yeah, I agree. This is one of the manufactured reasons, the fake myth, that was manufactured within the last few years to justify a long U.S. presence in Iraq. But from the Iraqi point of view, Iraqis know that there was no presence of Al-Qaeda in Iraq before 2003, and they know that the only space that Al-Qaeda is hiding in now in Iraq is the space created by Iraqis to resist the occupation led by the U.S. So the only space that Al-Qaeda is hiding in was created actually by the U.S. presence there, because Iraqis in general see resisting the occupation legitimate, and therefore foreign groups or groups with foreign ideology like Al-Qaeda can hide in that space and claim that they are fighting against the U.S.-led occupation, and therefore not be attacked, you know, with a full force, strength by the majority of Iraqis who are against any foreign intervention, whether it was from Al-Qaeda or the U.S. or Iran or any other place.
So Joshua, the thesis of your article, and as expressed by Raed, is essentially that because there is near unanimity amongst Iraqis that they don't want an occupying force in Iraq, that they are willing to forgive the presence of so-called Al-Qaeda in Iraq because they are fighting the Americans as well. Now, and the idea is that if the Americans were to leave, what would happen, Joshua?
Well, I mean, that is the sense. The idea that we're given by the administration and certainly the coalition authorities in Baghdad is that within the Sunni community, there's kind of a coherent block. There's a consistent position among Sunni Iraqis. And what we discover is a very different picture where there's deep divisions within this community. And there is a portion of that community that is basically tolerating this group, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which, as Raed says, is profoundly unpopular among Iraqis. They're tolerating them solely because they have some legitimacy in terms of their resistance to the U.S. occupation. And the classic tenet, of course, of counterinsurgency is that, you know, a very small group can mount a very effective resistance, but only if they have some local support, only if they have some legitimacy within the community. So what we're saying is essentially we're speaking with people who are influential in the Sunni community who are saying to us, we would join in an effort to eradicate Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but we won't do it because we see that effort as being an effort that's tied to the occupation forces and tied to a government in Baghdad dominated by Shiites that has, you know, very, very little legitimacy in this community. So what we're saying is that, you know, the United States presence is creating a division that allows Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is only loosely associated with Al-Qaeda that we know, to survive.
So if I understand you correctly, to the extent that there have been any Sunnis that have decided to accept the help of the American forces and have decided to essentially provide for a truce with American forces to fight Al-Qaeda, it's not because of the presence of Americans. It's actually despite the presence of Americans that they have actually been able to do this, and they'd be able to garner a lot more broad-based Sunni support to fight Al-Qaeda if the Americans weren't there giving the AQI, I guess they call it, a reason to actually exist there.
Well, that's exactly the case. I think that it's a mistake to think that there is this great movement within the Sunni community to embrace the Americans and to start working with the Americans. This is certainly how President Bush has portrayed this relationship. What we're seeing when we get on the phone and talk to these people is that they are grudgingly not joining forces with the Americans so much as
taking their money,
resisting AQI.
And taking their money and their weapons. I mean, why wouldn't they take, if someone's going to hand you weapons to fight these people, why wouldn't you take them? Tell me a little bit more, Raed, tell me a little bit more about the divisions within the Sunni population. Because as far as we're told, they're just basically, it's just ex-Ba'athists.
Yeah, there are divisions inside the Sunni community and similar divisions in the Shia and secular and other communities in Iraq. There is a majority of Iraqi Sunnis who are nationalists against any type of foreign intervention. And as you mentioned, the majority of these Sunnis are actually and have been against Al-Qaeda's presence in Iraq all along. It's not like they are turning on Al-Qaeda now. In fact, the majority of these Sunni nationalist groups have had even armed conflicts with Al-Qaeda in the streets. They had street fights with Al-Qaeda because they view Al-Qaeda's presence as a threat to Iraq's future, because these Sunni nationalists and other Shia nationalists and secular nationalists are against Al-Qaeda's presence because it's foreign and because it's extremist. and because it's a separatist organization that wants to create a separate Sunni state in the middle of Iraq, exclusively Sunni state. So Iraqis in general, whether they were Sunnis or Shia or Kurds, view Al-Qaeda in Iraq in the same bunker of the Iranian parties that are trying to split Iraq into three regions, or the Israeli intervention that's trying to support a Kurdistan independence, or the U.S. intervention. So you can see that, you know, it's way more complicated than what the U.S. is or the U.S. administration is trying to portray it. And this division within the Sunni community, the majority of the Sunni community is against the Al-Qaeda's presence there. So it's not that they are turning against Al-Qaeda because of the U.S. presence. They are actually fighting Al-Qaeda all along. And the ones of them who decided to coordinate this work with the U.S. are being attacked by the rest of the Sunni community, like what happened with the Sheikh who shook the hand of President Bush when, you know, Abu Risha, the Sheikh who shook the hand of the president in Ramadi, and was killed after some 10 days, I think, by someone from his own tribal coalition. Not because the person who killed Abu Risha wasn't working for the Al-Qaeda, but he thought that, you know, just coordinating with the U.S. and with the occupation authorities was illegitimate.
All right. Well, guys, this is a great piece, and I'm going to try and have you back on another program. We can talk about this more. Only a U.S. withdrawal will stop Al-Qaeda in Iraq by Raed Gerar and Joshua Holland. It is posted on Alternate. We'll put a link up to this piece. We actually have one on the front page of samcedarshow.com. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me. The number is 800-989-1480. We'll be right back. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on NovAm Radio, streaming live at NovAmRadio.com. Our number, 800-989-1480. You can also blog live at SamCedarShow.com. The Sammy Cam is in effect. You can see myself in all my glory and Lauren in all her glory. She's waving now. Proof again that I do spend my pre-show time researching and not working on my hygiene or yes, or shaving. Let's get an update on what's going on at draftgore.com. Rich in New Jersey, welcome to the program, Rich.
Hey, Sam, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How you doing, Rich?
All right, man. It's been a while since we talked, but anyway, I was listening to Jeff Farias on November preceding you, and he talked about Draft Gore, and I've been on the position signatory website says about 7:45.
Uh-huh.
And we are less than 200 from going over the 150,000 mark.
Well, that's huge. I mean, you know, I am glad people are doing this. I think it's a great thing if we could get Gore into this race. I think that we also have candidates that could win, but I would love to see Gore jump in. He should have been president for the past 8 years. This country would have been in a lot better shape were it so, and I have a feeling the Democratic Party would be in a lot better shape in terms of being progressive. So,
well, you know what scares me, Sam, the whole thing here? The only thing that my reservation with the whole thing is I think I understand that I'm going to put my tinfoil hat on now. If you want to knock it off my head, go ahead. But I'm going to put my tinfoil hat on and think maybe the reason he's holding back is because he doesn't want to end up with the fishies, if you get my drift. Because
yes,
this guy is so revolutionary with what he's proposing to do about global climate change. If he has the bully pulpit of the White House, it's going to be threatening to a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, these days it's hard to knock tinfoil hats off of people's heads with what's gone on in this country. But I got to think that it's probably also because, look, there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't want to run. you know, the least of which was his experience last time, the way he was just sort of eviscerated by the press. And it's, you know, listen, it's a nasty business, and it's a very tough thing to do, and he's living a pretty good life, and he may feel that he can do more for global warming as a private citizen than he could as a president. I mean, who knows? But I appreciate the call, Rich. Good luck.
Have a good night, Sam.
Good luck, and we will keep you updated. Obviously, Rich knows, but we will keep you updated as to what's going on at DraftGore.com. It's definitely going to go over 150,000 people. May happen in the next 3 minutes, for all I know. Some decent news coming out of the House Judiciary Committee today. We spoke to Glenn Greenwald about this last night. The Restore Act, which is essentially an attempt to roll back some of what was rolled back on the FISA law. This is the law that basically says that you must have a warrant if you're going to... wiretap people who involved conversations with American people on American soil. And the House Judiciary Committee passed a bill, the Restore Act, like I said, out of the committee on a vote of 2014. There are some very positive elements to this. There are some not so positive elements. The worst thing about this bill, and one of the things that's got the ACLU pretty upset about it, is that it still provides for these blanket, or I should say umbrella warrants, where the process, simply the process, not the targets of wiretapping, are receive a warrant. Now, there was an amendment by Jackson Lee from Texas, and she offered an amendment that required the administration to obtain a regular FISA warrant whenever, quote, a significant purpose of an acquisition is to acquire the communications of a specific person reasonably believed to be located in the United States, rather than waiting until a said person formally becomes a target. So one of the fears about one of these umbrella warrants is that it's to go on a fishing expedition, or to couch it in the context of a fishing expedition, when in fact you're actually zeroing in on some individual Americans. This would prevent that. Jerry Nadler offered an amendment to improve court oversight over the government's compliance with the FISA court orders by requiring the court to assess compliance with its orders as opposed to merely authorizing it to do so. In other words, the court can jump back in and make sure that what they have signed off on is actually happening, rather than a one-time, okay, we okay the program, go off and be well. And a third amendment to the bill's auditing and reporting requirements. The current standard is that acquisition must be with significant purpose of gathering foreign intelligence. This amendment seeks to obtain information about what additional purposes for which the government may be collecting. The biggest thing, of course, is that there is no retroactive immunity, and Jerry Nadler from New York was terrific in the House Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties, speaking in Congress today at the what they call the markup. This is where the bill is given amendments and then sent out of committee. This is number 6.
Finally, let me say a word about retroactive immunity. If the administration broke the law, if it broke the law, and if it asked telecom communications to break the law, and if they broke the law, they should object to lawsuits. And if they didn't break the law, that's why they have millions and millions of dollars worth of lawyers, and that's why we have courts to determine whether they broke the law. To retroactively immunize anybody and say, if you broke the law, it's okay, we don't want to know about it, is to surrender the law. We heard a lot about the rule of law about 10 years ago in this room. It is crucial that, especially in an era when the administration uses the state secrets doctrine to prevent people who think they were illegally wiretapped from bringing a lawsuit, it is crucial that private suits against telecommunications companies be permitted, because only that way can the courts determine whether, in fact, the administration broke the law, whether, in fact, the telecommunications companies broke the law. And if they did, they should be held accountable. If they didn't, let the courts find that out. We shouldn't short-circuit that. And we certainly shouldn't say that you are free to break the law if an administration asks you to in the name of national security. If the administration says, we're breaking the law, why don't you join us, you have a responsibility to say no. Otherwise, you have lawless administrations like this one getting away with even more than they have.
Jerry Nadler getting a standing O. Not so much in the House as much as in this studio. And, of course, George Bush, so desperate to get this immunity, one has to ask a question. Why? I wonder why George Bush would think it's so important to offer immunity to these companies. It suggests that maybe they did something wrong. Let's hear the bubble boy himself beg and try and sell to the American public. This is what the funniest part about this thing is. He's trying to sell to the American public that somehow it is important to our national security that anybody who broke the law in the past get off scot-free. This is number 7.
My administration will work with members of Congress from both sides of the aisle to reach an agreement on a bill that will allow us to protect our country.
I don't think so.
The final bill must meet certain criteria. It must give our intelligence professionals the tools and flexibility they need to protect our country. It must keep the intelligence gap firmly closed and ensure that protections intended for the American people are not extended to terrorists overseas who are plotting to harm us. And it must grant liability protection to companies who are facing multi-billion dollar lawsuits only because they are believed to have assisted in the efforts to defend our nation following the 9/11 attacks.
Oh, it's so important to our national security. The God forbid, God forbid. Poor little AT&T and poor little Quest, or actually, I think Quest was one of the few that didn't, right? Poor little AT&T was going to be subjected to some lawsuits. Boo-hoo! What has that got to do with our national security? They're going to get subjected to lawsuits? Well, then why don't you, George Bush, why don't you just come up and say we're going to indemnify them? Why, I mean, if you're really worried about it, if you really think this is going to be a threat to the national security of the United States, that AT&T is going to have to use its legions of lawyers to defend themselves against a lawsuit, why don't you come out and tell the American public that what you want to do is spend $1 billion? Let's just make it $1 billion. Let's make it $2 billion, just in case, so that you're not too afraid of getting sued. You're going to indemnify them up to $2 billion so that the telecommunication companies won't have anything to worry about if they happen to break the law. Pathetic. All right, folks, you did it. 150,009 as of 9:44 Eastern Standard Time, according to Joy. The draft Al Gore petition has broken through 150,000 just in time for the Nobel Prize, maybe to be awarded to Al Gore. Certainly would make things interesting. I don't know, as one of our IMers said, if he's revolutionary, but certainly in this context, it would be a wonderful victory. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. The number is 800-989-1480. 800-989-1480. I welcome conservative calls. I don't know why you could tell me that you don't believe the United States torture, or that you probably would say it's all right to torture. Tell me who you're voting for. I'm curious. Is it the dud, the flip-flopper, or the psychopath? I think I probably just described all of them, though. Let's go to Charlie in Fort Lauderdale. Welcome to the program, Charlie.
Sam.
Charlie.
Great to hear you again, man.
Charlie, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing good.
You in Fort Lauderdale? You're not in Brooklyn?
No, down in Florida for a while.
Snowbird.
Anyway, you know, I'm getting this, like, deja vu. Didn't we go through this with the Military Commissions Act about a year ago when he tried to indemnify and actually got away with it all the people who tortured? He put a specific provision in there to get them off the hook. And it's symbolic to me. This is this guy's whole life. He skates. Reagan called him a ne'er-do-well. He keeps screwing up, and he always gets picked up by his daddy or some other way, never has to pay any consequences for his impulsive malfeasance. And here again, he went to these, you know, telecommunication companies without any warrants, and he's trying to get them to write it into the law to get them off the hook because of his bad decision-making.
Well, but wait a second, Charlie. Why do you think that he wants to get them off the hook? I mean, it's very obvious why he wants to get them off
the
hook.
There's cronies. That's his base.
No, it's not just that, Charlie. Look, I mean, play this out. Okay, this is what happens. If they are not indemnified, if they're not given immunity, tomorrow, the next day, you start getting lawsuits. Now, once those lawsuits go down the path here, you have a situation where you have things like discovery. And during discovery, the biggest defense that they're going to have is that, well, the president told us to do it. And what he is afraid of is that this is the way that he will end up being accountable. This isn't a gift to his cronies, Charlie. He's covering his own ass here.
It's both. I believe it's both. You know, somebody pointed out today, John Dean earlier pointed out that, actually, I think it was Bruce Fine, that Watergate began with just a bunch of burglars. They didn't know anything. They indicted these burglars and started pushing and probing, and the whole filthy thing came out. And if we don't have the courage, our Congress doesn't have the courage to investigate this, he'll skate and get away with it. Just like, did you see Time magazine last week about Don Siegelman in Alabama?
Yeah,
the same guy who fingered Siegelman fingered Pryor, that goofy judge who had no experience he put on, and Jeff Sessions. But
yeah.
Rove's crony, who was the DA's husband, never investigated this. They've been getting away with a whole raft of crimes for the past 7 years.
Well, I'll
and
tell you
this is one that I really think should not be allowed.
I agree with you, Charlie. I appreciate the phone call. And I do not think they're going to get away, or it's not clear to me yet that they're going to get away with the Siegelman thing. Later in the program, I will speak to that. Apparently, Gonzo has lawyered up. The day he left office, he got himself a lawyer, apparently a guy who was actually in line to replace him. They ended up going to Mukasey because maybe Bush realized, like, don't worry, Fredo, I won't take away your lawyer. You're going to need it. I'm free. Wouldn't it be funny if you ended up in jail and I didn't? Oh, let's go to Ross, driving on the road. That's the best place to be driving, Ross. Ross?
Hello.
Ross, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can.
Hey, this is Ron. Pretty close.
All right.
Hey, man, I'm a real-life a mouse in a wheel. But before I get to that, this whole thing with this AT&T and these other telecommunications, this is Saddam's execution with this kangaroo court so we can make sure that none of this comes out in the open. The same damn thing. But anyway, get back to my economic status here. I actually work 6 to 7 days a week. I pay about $14,000 a year in insurance, about $18,000 a year in fuel. The government won't allow me to get an air car, which they have over in Europe for the last 3 years. Some moratorium on that. And, you know, I just find it amazing that they tell us that nothing has gone up. Food's gone up double. Fuel's gone up 225% since Clinton's left.
Yep.
I mean, I am a real-life mouse in a wheel. If you saw me, you would say, my God, that guy works 7 days a week, 14 hours a day. I have no social life because I'm trying to be honest. I'm trying to pay my bills. You know, the government mandates I have to have these insurance. My water, sewage, and trash is $2,500 a year. My dad used to pay $7 a month for that service.
Well, this is the thing, Ron. This is the game that they the elites play when they say that the inflation is no problem. Because what they do is they say, well, core inflation is fine, because they strip out the costs of oil, essentially. Yeah. And oil, when you have an increase in oil, and when you have an increase in things like copper and whatnot, it drives up the price of everything.
Yeah,
everything. Food delivery, everything goes up. And, of course, health insurance, health care costs have gone up double digits in the past 6 years as well.
I pay $10,000 a year for health insurance for my wife and I. We're both healthy.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous.
Well, I'll tell you, Ron, you should not say that too loudly, because unless the right wing hears you protest about rising health care costs, and about any potential for a government program that could help out with that. Apparently, what the right-wingers will do now is Mitch McConnell will send out, or someone from his staff will send out some type of series of lies to right-wing bloggers. They will post your name and address in the right-wing blogosphere and then send some racist hack like Michelle Malkin down to your place of work, into your house, to harass you. Excuse me. Forgive me, I've misspoken. They'll only do that if you're a 12-year-old boy who is trying to recover from a coma. We'll talk about this more after this break. It's despicable. These people are despicable. Sam Cedar in from Mike Malloy, 800-989-1480. Coming up in the next hour, we'll be talking to Maggie Mahar about money-driven medicine. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. We'll be right back.
Charter-like electric underwear. Any idea that never had a chance to go anywhere. This is who you are, a celebrity who drives off a bridge in a car, your beautiful body filling up with water.
We are back. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio, streaming live at NovaMRadio.com. The number 800-989-1480. We're blogging live at SamCedarShow.com. Get on the Sammy Cam. You can see myself and Lauren in all our glories, as it were. U.S. officials will probe leak of Bin Laden video. This is a weird story, folks. But it is classic, classic Bush administration. First of all, this administration is so horrible for our national security in so many different ways. It really becomes almost impossible to enumerate. I touched on this story the other night. We all remember the amazing coincidence that every time there is a major vote or a major milestone or something, a report on Iraq, in this case it was General Petraeus, or any time there is some type of discussion of FISA, there always seems to be some new manifestation of the threat of Al-Qaeda. When George Bush's poll ratings dropped before 2004, all of a sudden the color coding would shine red, or whatever color it was, fuchsia. That was to suggest that we should all be pissing our pants in fear. When the FISA law was pushed through in August, it was done with the backdrop of a now debunked and, by all accounts, fake story that Al-Qaeda was targeting Capitol Hill and that an attack on Capitol Hill could be imminent. And prior to, or just as, General Petraeus was to give his dog and pony show in front of the House and the Senate September 10th and 11th, there was an Osama bin Laden video that surfaced. And apparently this Osama bin Laden video, prior to it being widely disseminated publicly, it had traveled amongst the intranet of some sort of Islamic terrorist groups. And it was a private intelligence company that monitors these groups that obtained this video ahead of its so-called official release. They had found it around September 7th. I guess it was specifically on September 7th. The company, the site intelligence group, says the what they did is they gave this video to the White House and begged them, please do not release this. In fact, you can only have it on the condition that the officials not reveal they had it until the Al-Qaeda official release. In other words, you had a private organization, a security group, that had somehow cracked at least one leg of the communication loop within the Al-Qaeda online, I guess, communication system, and had intercepted this video, showed it to the Bush administration so they could get ahead of, they could begin to analyze it. And they said, you cannot reveal this until it is disseminated by Al-Qaeda themselves. Otherwise, they'll know that we have somehow cracked their network. Within 20 minutes, a range of intelligence agencies had begun downloading it from the company's website. By mid-afternoon that day, the video and a transcript of its audio had been leaked from within the Bush administration to Fox News. The founder of the company's site said this premature disclosure tipped Al-Qaeda to a security breach and destroyed a years-long surveillance operation. So let's hear Evan Coleman, a terrorism expert and founder of GlobalTerrorAlert.com, on MSC's Countdown with Keith Olbermann last night. This is number three.
Did somebody just give away the kind of advantage, whether it's huge or it's little, but the kind of advantage that the rest of the counterterrorism world spends, you know, 18 hours a day trying to gain?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very unusual edge what they had gotten. About over the last approximate year, there have been a number of us that have managed to snake various loopholes into Al-Qaeda's distribution system. And we've been able to get copies, advanced copies of Al-Qaeda videos before they're coming out. Now, it happens in to different degrees, and some people use different loopholes. It happened that the loophole that the Site Institute had it secured for itself was remarkably ingenious, and it was quite unusual, and I would be shocked to hear that anyone in the U.S. government has an equivalent on their own without the assistance of Site. Now, what is the ultimate impact? Well, if the Site Institute finds a bin Laden video tomorrow ahead of the U.S. government, you better bet they're not going to turn to the U.S. government, or they're certainly not going to turn to the White House. And as far as what the White House did in this case, I got to tell you, I mean, I was getting requests for this video from U.S. law enforcement on that day. So apparently whoever was at the White House or whoever was at the DNI who was supposed to be in charge of getting this video out was not doing a very good job, because it didn't get out to U.S. law enforcement immediately.
Ugh.
So, I mean, that, you know, this is just the reality of things, is that Fox News had this transcript and had this video in some cases before FBI agents did.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd, lay, hood, lay, hood, lay, hee-hoo.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen.
Goat herd, lay, hood, lay, hood,
I'm trying to imagine. Why would the Bush administration want to make sure that Fox News had this video first? Why was that more important than actually getting it out to our so-called homeland security apparatus? Huh. I wonder if it has anything to do with the Petraeus hearings. Well, of course, as is the theme for these thugs, and I don't know if it's just incompetence or it's... they don't really care about keeping America safe. They care about keeping America scared. And if you understand that simple fact, everything they do makes a lot more sense. If you are worried about keeping Americans afraid, the best thing for you to do is get it out there as soon as possible, even before you get it to law enforcement. Because what would make Americans even more afraid? Local law enforcement people going, we don't know anything about it. And so who leaked the bin Laden video? Well, Let's try and get our answers from Dana Perino. Number one.
You said this morning in the gaggle that the White House did not leak the information about the bin Laden tape. How do you know that?
Well, this is, let me take you back. This is the video. There was a private company that contacted the White House to let us know that they had found an Osama bin Laden tape, asked us if we wanted to have the federal government review it. When the standard practice at the White House is to take that phone call, to take that request, and direct it directly to the DNI's office. So we did not ask to have that information just solely reviewed at the White House. We immediately turned it over to the National Center for Counterterrorism. That's what Fred Fielding and Joel Bagnell did, the two people who were aware of the link, and it went to the DNI. It went to the NCTC. And to the extent that we have Americans coming forward to provide us information, whether it be a private citizen or a private corporation or anybody in America that can provide the government information, we take it very seriously that they should, one, feel comfortable in providing that information, that their sources will be protected, and that we will act on it if necessary. We appreciate what they did. This was a cause of concern that the information was leaked. And I would have to refer to the DNI's office in regards to any possible investigation into that leak.
Now, I'll just tell you folks that my 2-year-old daughter's diapers smell better than this answer. The question was, you said the White House did not leak this. How do you know that? Dana Perino went on to say, well, let's back up. Let's go way back. When I was 10, she talks about standard practice. And she says, yeah, well, let me tell you what standard practice is. We receive this and we hand it off to National Counterterrorism Center or the Office of Director of National Intelligence. And so it's not just solely reviewed at the White House. Okay, so she's not saying that we didn't leak it. She's saying, well, we weren't the only person who could have leaked it. You should go and ask. You should go and ask the people at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. When we come back, we'll hear from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And it seems to me they're saying to Dana Perino, you want to lay this on us? It ain't going to work out that way. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy, 800-989-1480. We'll be right back after this. Stand before me. Now we stare out of eye. Before another second weeks away, one of us will die. You reach for your medal as I reach for mine. The sound of bullets flying through the air is followed by a cry, and the cry. So Dana Perino, when asked as to who was responsible for leaking this video, and I should say also that this video, apparently, there was a lot of things funky about it. Apparently there was about a half a dozen at least splices in the video, and it froze up every time Bin Laden, ostensibly Bin Laden, spoke about things that would have put it in the present day. So the video itself is very suspect, apparently. And I'm getting this from the CNET blog. So Dana Perino is asked the question, how do you know the White House didn't leak this? You say the White House didn't leak it. How do you know? Well, it's standard practice that we give it to other people, and we're not the only people who looked at the video. The other people who looked at the video was the Office of Director of National Intelligence, or the National Counterterrorism Center. And so someone in the White House press pool decides to ask the obvious question, so was it leaked at the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence? Here it is, number two.
You referred questions about the leak of the Bin Laden tape to DNI. Is that a way of suggesting the leak might have come from DNI?
No. The Director of National Intelligence, as the overseer and coordinator of all intelligence agencies, that's the appropriate place for me to refer you.
And you expressed concern about the leak. Is it because of the damage it may have done to site, or the damage it may have done to national counterterrorism efforts?
I think it would be both.
Yeah, I'll say it would be both. So wait a second. So she says that, well, I know we didn't leak it because we also gave it to the Director of National Intelligence. You should ask them about this. So were you implying that they leaked it? No. Well, the Washington Post today reports that Ross Feinstein, a spokesman for the Director of National Intelligence, said, at this point, we don't think there was a leak from the Office of Director of National Intelligence or the National Counterterrorism Center. In other words, F you, Dana Perino, you guys leaked it. Do you really think that the Director of National Intelligence or the National Counterterrorism Center is going to leak it to Fox News? I'm trying to think. What could possibly be the connection between the White House and Fox News in September of this year? I'm trying to think. Is there anybody who might have a connection at the White House in September of 2007 to Fox News? Why do the word snow come up in my mind? Why am I seeing something snowy and tonoey or tony-y? Unbelievable, these people. Just unbelievable. This is number five, Evan Coleman again, terrorism expert.
We don't want to resort to hysteria, and the last thing that we want to do is spread Al-Qaeda's message the way that they want us to, which is spreading a transcript to the American people. There was nothing in this Bin Laden video that had any value that Americans needed to read it then and there. So to help distribute it to Americans, you're just helping the Al-Qaeda in their mission.
Well, there you have it. You want to know why this was leaked? You want to know who leaked it? The same people who have been aiding and abetting Al-Qaeda since 9/11, the Bush administration. They have been carrying this man's water since day one. You want to come to America and terrorize our population? We can get on board with that. We can help you do that. We'll build a whole apparatus to do that. We will find any way we can to terrorize the American public. Hell, 2008, we hope to run a nominee whose whole campaign will be built on terrorizing the American public. He'll hold fundraisers. Well, it will cost you $9.11 to get in. Unbelievable. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Maggie Mahar. She's the author of Money Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much. I guess countdown until the right-wingers start camping out in front of her house. I hope she doesn't have any children. Oh, they'll terrorize them. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. We'll be right back after this.
across the street. Supposed to be protecting me, storing every little file. Make a promise and take a while. Hooked up to
Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy on Nova M Radio. On the phone, Maggie Mahar is the author of Bull, A History of the Boom and Bust, 1982 to 2004. She's a financial journalist for Money Magazine, the New York Times, and Bloomberg, and she has most recently authored Money-Driven Medicine, The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much. Welcome to the program, Maggie.
Thank you.
So, Maggie, why does healthcare cost so much?
Okay, it costs so much because we have decided to make healthcare a for-profit business, which it isn't in most parts of the developed world, but here it really is. And that creates an inevitable conflict of interest between the people who are trying to make a profit for their shareholders, which is what they're supposed to be doing, and the people who are trying to buy health care, which is becoming more and more unaffordable. As you know, we pay more for drugs and devices than any other country in the world. Meanwhile, drug and device makers are making a handsome profit on these items, a profit that's higher than the profit in the case of drug makers than virtually any other industry in the S&P 500. And it's not clear why drugs that sick people need should be more profitable than, say, automobiles, but they are in the U.S. We also have a big problem, but we have two problems. As we all know, some people in the U.S. get way too little health care or they get it too late. And these are people who don't have insurance or are uninsured, or maybe they have a high deductible, and so they put off getting care. At the other extreme, many people in this country are overtreated. They're getting more care than they need, sometimes even more care than they want, and here I'm thinking of end-of-life care, and that unnecessary care in the form of unnecessary hospitalizations, unnecessary tests, unnecessary procedures, unproven sometimes procedures, adds up to a point where it's estimated that one out of three of our health care dollars is wasted on care that does the patient no good.
So basically, there are three points. One is that the drug makers make an extraordinary profits, higher than in any really other industry. Essentially, delayed maintenance insofar as your brakes are a little squeaky, you don't do anything about it, then you end up running into a tree. I guess the human equivalent of that. And then overtreatment. What accounts for the overtreatment? Is it simply just people being cautious, or is it doctors basically trying to, and I guess hospitals trying to just make as much cash as possible?
It's not really that, but this is a very interesting part. Over the last 2.5 decades, researchers up at Dartmouth Medical Hospital and School have been looking into what drives overtreatment. And what they found, first of all, is that in some parts of the country, in some cities, Medicare is spending twice as much per beneficiary as in others. And they looked at Medicare patients who were very similar, who to look see how much treatment they got during the last 2 years of their life. So these are people who were quite sick. Then they adjusted for differences in prices in different cities. They adjusted for differences in race, racial composition. They adjusted for differences in age. And they adjusted for differences in the overall health of the population. For instance, they knew that in some places in Colorado, you would expect Medicare to spend less. And then in Mobile, Alabama, which is one of the least healthy areas in the country, you would expect Medicare to spend more. After adjusting for all of that, they found that Medicare was spending twice as much on very similar patients in some areas than in others. And here's the kicker. The outcomes were no better, and often they were worse. These patients were being hospitalized more. They were more likely to see 10 or more specialists in the final 6 months of life. They were more likely to die in an ICU. They were having more procedures and more operations. Now, what was driving all of that? Why these differences? And this is the part that's perhaps not surprising when you think about it, but a little shocking. The areas where patients got more care were areas where there were many more hospital beds, and many more specialists. In other words, supply was driving demand. Build the beds, and they will come. And this is all happening not, you know, it's not that doctors were consciously setting out to fill these hospital beds, or the specialists were setting out consciously to make more money by doing more business. But if there are more hospital beds in the city, the doctor unconsciously, subconsciously knows that there's probably a bed available. He has a patient with congestive heart failure. There are no clear rules or guidelines as to when that patient should be in the hospital or when should be fined at home. It's easier for him probably to hospitalize her. He doesn't have to worry about getting calls from her relatives in the middle of the night. There are nurses watching her. It's easier for him to call in other specialists to look at her. And so he may well hospitalize her, even though it's a very gray area as to whether she needs to be in the hospital or not. Similarly, with specialists seeing patients more often, specialists tend to fill their appointment books. If you're a cardiologist and you're working in a town where there are twice as many cardiologists, and you look at your appointment book, you may well find that you can see that patient every 3 months. If you were in a town where there were half as many cardiologists, you'd wind up seeing that same patient every 6 months. And again, there's no clear guidelines as to how often you should be seeing that patient. So supply, availability, excess capacity tends to drive the doctor's decision. And the sad thing is that the patient is seen more often and hospitalized more often doesn't do any better.
And in fact, in some instances, it sounds like they do worse.
Exactly, because over-treatment is hazardous to your health. Being in a hospital, if you don't need to be there, it's a dangerous place to be. You can pick up infections. We know that every treatment, even a test, carries some risk as well as benefit. If you're not getting any benefit from it, if it's over-treatment, then you're just being exposed to the risk.
So, and you know, I mean, I guess, you know, to be fair, obviously this excess capacity, it's also... I guess, combined with the profit incentive. I mean, it's not simply just a question of excess capacity. If, you know, if it's there, if you have the supply and you actually make more money off it, it's worthwhile to do.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a hospital building boom going on in this country that's been going on for a few years, and it's questionable in many areas whether those extra rooms are needed. People say, well, the baby boomers are going to need them. More and more baby boomers are getting their care as outpatients. They're not staying overnight in the hospital. They're going to be aging, not all at once, but over the next 20 years, just the way they were born over a period of 20 years. Upper middle class and upper class baby boomers are healthier than their parents, so the chances are many of them will never see a hospital until they're 80, as opposed to in their late 60s. That means we're looking at the baby boomers maybe needing hospital beds over the next 30 years. And meanwhile, this is a terrible thing, we don't have enough nurses to staff the hospital floors that we have now. We have a significant shortage of nurses because there aren't enough professors in nursing schools to take all the students who are trying to apply. There aren't enough nursing schools. So we're turning away people who would like to become nurses. Professors in nursing schools are actually paid less than people who are practicing nursing. So it's hard to find teachers, and the bottom line is we've got this serious shortage of nurses, which anyone who's been in a hospital recently may well know, that if you call for a nurse, there may not be anyone available. And yet we're building more beds. And people, of course, are making money on this building. There are hospital architects, there are construction people. It creates jobs in the community. It seems like a good thing. It seems like growth. But in healthcare, more care is not always better care, and growth is not always good.
All right. Well, Maggie, listen. It's the book is fascinating, and it is it's an incredibly important topic, and obviously it's being addressed at least to a certain extent by the presidential candidates in this run. And I would like to speak to you more about it in the future. Phone's a little bit shaky, and we'll talk more about this. We'll be in touch. We'll do this again.
Okay, I would love to do that.
The book is Money Driven Medicine: The Real Reason Healthcare Costs So Much, and it is a fascinating read, and obviously an issue that is hopefully will be addressed in the near term. Maggie Mahar, thanks for joining us. We got to take a break. 800-989-1480. Sam Cedar filling in for Mike Malloy. We are back. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. 800-989-1480. 800-989-1480. I welcome conservative phone callers. I don't know if there's many left anymore. They may have tried to escape the country. Armand in Florida. Welcome to the program, Armand.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. I'd like to talk to you and your guest. I think, personally, from my evaluation, I'm not claiming to be a professional, but I'm a participant out here and just a common person. And my vision of one of the biggest problems we have to overcome to move this country forward in a progressive manner as far as health care and delivery goes, until we get the insurance companies totally out of it, I don't think we're really going to progress the way that we're going to have to do, considering how many baby boomers are going to come on the demand cycle into the future and everything else being equal, and all of our trade deals we're doing and deindustrializing and everything else, I think we're just going to grind to a complete halt until that happens. And if you go back to 1993 or 1994, when there was a town hall meeting and Hillary Clinton was there with Tom Brokaw, and 70% to 80% of the people in the crowd were clapping and cheering and promoting a Canadian-style system here that leaves out the insurance companies and, you know, favored it. And Hillary, back then even, she said, it's just never going to happen. You know, it's just not the way to do it. You know, we want the gatekeeper to be insurance companies. And I think that she's not going to do the right thing. I don't want to just criticize her. There's a lot of things to criticize about her, but I think she's taken so much money, and the politicians in Washington are taking so much money. We're just going around in a circle, around in a circle. There's more people in this country now. There's 100 million of us, like myself, that has a pre-existing condition that the insurance companies screwed over and threw us out. We can't afford insurance now. Or people that have absolute useless, crappy insurance because they can't afford a better grade that's, you know, out here, a third of us in this country. And I just look at Europe, and if you read the Post article today in the Washington Post about Europe, you know, you can't believe what the corporate media lies about here. If you read the Post article, you'll see that on all the statistical analysis of progression and middle class and progressiveness, Europe's kicking our butt right now. And this whole Reaganomics thing is just a total failure, like Hartman says and many other people. And anyway, I'm sorry I went around the world, but
well,
I just
no,
think...
but Armand, look, here's the bottom line. You're absolutely right. Ultimately, we need to get out
single payer.
Single payer. I mean, that's what we need.
And can I say one other thing real quick, please, Sam? And Sam, yeah. I think that you're very brilliant. You're very intelligent. I don't know if we'll always get along, but I'll tell you, you're a very educated person and very articulate. And, I mean, your parents did a good job of raising you.
Oh.
And I'd like to say one other thing. There's one thing that Clinton was pushing, even though it was with insurance companies, that I think we should adapt if we can get a single-payer system. And I think it would protect all of us with a social safety net as far as our health care goes, and would keep us more collective economically so that we don't have these booms and busts like we've been having that's very detrimental to the good of the economy and restarting back up. Is it should be based on a percent or a progressive percent of your income, so that if your income goes down, then your responsibility for health care is proportionate to your lack of income, so that we can all have balance here and we can have a real good system if we do that. But with a fixed cost system like insurance or insurance through the government or whatever, the problem is everything's so erratic in our economy now and so unpredictable that when masses of people get laid off, it affects like a wavelength through the whole economy and everything. And if they got these fixed costs and the safety net goes out of your income, like here in Florida, we're in real estate and our incomes went 80% down, we can't even think about affording insurance. So the whole thing's screwed up. So it's got to be, you know,
Armand, listen, I appreciate your comment, and I got to let me address it. Let me let you go and address it when you get off. But I appreciate it and thank you for the kind words. I hope my parents aren't listening. I don't want them to get too full of themselves. I mean, look, I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I know what's in Hillary Clinton's head. It is in black and white that she receives more money from the insurance company than the insurance industry than any other candidate that's running. They must have a sense that it is valuable to them to have her put in office. With that said, her plan, which is very much like the Edwards plan, and frankly, I think Edwards' plan forced her to go in that route, does offer an opportunity for some competition between an extended Medicare plan and private insurance, which I think would be at least the beginning of tearing it down. Now, there's two ways to approach this, and unfortunately, we're really only seeing one. I mean, Kucinich is offering a single payer, basically an extended Medicare plan for everybody. But for better or for worse, he's not going to win the nomination from the Democrats. And I frankly don't believe that he could win a national election. Not indicative of my feeling of his position. It's simply indicative of the reality of the United States of America right now. And it's not even a function of whether or not people would agree with his positions. It's how those positions would get disseminated and how much people are paying attention. But the bottom line is that we are missing in the front runners somebody who's going to come out and push for universal health care. With that said, Paul Krugman had a piece the other day that said, look, you know, based on the climate, these plans, if they can be enacted, are a good first step. And frankly, that's what you need to do. You need to begin to slowly hack away at it. There isn't either the national will or efficiencies in the system that are allowing that national will to express itself properly, where our politicians are feeling they have to come out with a single-payer system. But of course, I mean, the bottom line is, this is what her book is all about, and if her phone was better, we'd be hearing more about it. It's the profit motive. Do you want to have our medicine delivered with job number one to provide profit to the people who supply it to you? Or do you want our medicine like we expect out of our police force and our fire departments and our federal emergency management and our EPA and our FDA and the SEC and every other function, many other functions that are socialized, in quotes? Do you want job number one to be to provide health care? And if you want that to be job number one, then you have to make profit secondary. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Cliff Schechter, and he may very well be on the Sammy camp. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy.
I just ran away from home. our President George, I'm going to Disneyland.
Sam Cedar filling in for for Mike Malloy on NovAm Radio. Streaming live at NovAmRadio.com. Number is 800-989-1480. It is a real pleasure to welcome to the program Cliff Schechter. He blogs. You're not at CliffSchechter.blogspot.com anymore, right? You're at Brave New Films now.
That is correct.
BraveNewFilms.org.
CliffSchechter.BraveNewFilms.org. I got brought into the Borg.
I love it. And he is also appearing on the Sammy Cam, one of our first guests to ever do this, and in no less surrounded by books, which is very impressive.
It's all fake.
Cliff.
I read like two of them.
I'm sitting here with a stack of just the most sordid, disgusting, lurid stories, all about Republicans. And I'm not talking about the one about them going after this 12-year-old kid with the S-chip, about the S-chip thing, or leaking videos from Osama bin Laden, or pretending that the economy is going great, or destroying our government. Or being racist. I have those in front of me, too, but I'm just talking about sheer wetsuits. What's going on? Tell me the story.
There are some sick people, and this week has been a banner week for all of them. The story, the one that you're referring to, is the Reverend Gary Aldridge, who passed away and was found in his home. He went to Liberty University and was a protege of Jerry Falwell, so as you can imagine, a very tolerant man. And he was found in his home. He had died, I'm not sure, he died of asphyxiation. But it seems like there are about 10 other things there that could have killed him. He had, I think, two wetsuits on, flippers, rubberized underwear, some sort of a face mask. They found what they wouldn't report in the local newspaper was that they found a local, they found a, how shall we say, can we say it on the radio, a dildo, inserted in a part of him where the sun doesn't shine, with a condom on. So apparently he was practicing safe sex. I don't know what else to say, Sam. But, the GOP at your service.
Well, I mean, you know, listen, my theory has always been, you know, whatever gets you through the night or the afternoon or the morning or wherever it is that whatever time of day you're involved with. But I guess it's the bizarreness. You know, we see the story of Larry Craig. We see the same story from, you know, the story of Joey DeFatta?
Yeah, he was on the list of things we were potentially going to talk about. And the point you're making is exactly right, which is we almost see these carbon copies again and again. Joey DeFatta is a carbon copy of Larry Craig down to the tapping of the toes in the bathroom. He's in New Orleans, was it St. Bernard's Parish councilman? I think he's the head of the council. And was running for the state senate until it came out that he'd been stopped twice for lewd conduct. But
I mean, this is amazing. The report that Jefferson Parish deputies put out said that DeFatta slid his foot into the deputy's stall, tapped the deputy's foot. In the report, the deputy noted that such activity is common among men to indicate a willingness to participate in sex. The deputy inside the stall responded by tapping his foot. DeFatta reached under the partition, began to rub the deputy's leg. The detective asked DeFatta, "What do you want?" According to the report, he replied, "I just want to play with you." This is exactly like Larry Craig.
Yeah, this is as close as it gets. And another story that came up this week was the founder of all these boy bands, Lou Pearlman, big GOP donor who had run away to Indonesia because he got busted on this whole scam, Ponzi scheme type thing. But also, it's now come out that he was molesting some of the members of a number of prominent bands, NSYNC and others like that. Again, the other names aren't coming to me. Sorry, I'm not a big boy band guy. But, the point, does Mark Foley come to mind there? And then Oral Roberts University, where Mrs. Oral Roberts herself, apparently between 1 and 3 a.m., was placing phone calls to or text messages. She's spending $800 a month of university money. Apparently, a lot of it was going to text messages between 1 and 3 a.m. to underage males. I mean, that's one week, and I do a regular segment called Republican Sexcapades on another station, which I won't mention.
No, you do it on the Young Turks, right?
Okay, yeah, on the Young Turks on Air America. I didn't know if that was kosher to do.
And
we started doing this, you know, I started doing this in light of the last election as it was going on in 2006 because of Don Sherwood and Mayor Jim West. And, you know, we found all these guys, like these hypocrites. And, you know, that was before Haggard and Foley and Vitter. You know, and Craig, and this,
and
I mean,
Ed Schrock, and
right?
And the list goes on and on and on.
And it's, you know, every week I have no, you know, we have time for three stories. I have to try to fit four of them in this week. I mean, it's amazing. These guys every week. The fact of, and that this party can stand up and say that the party family values is absolutely insane, and it just ratifies my theory, which is those who scream the loudest about morality are often, in fact, doing themselves exactly. What it is that they're complaining about. Let me just say, you know, quickly before we go to something else potentially, on the case of the Alabama case they're just talking about, Alabama is one of the few states where sex toys are actually illegal. And I'm going to guess that this minister probably supported the Republicans and some Democrats there, all the right-wingers who made sex toys illegal, yet he's found with one in a part of him. How about we put it that way? So, I mean, the hypocrisy there, you know, and that's the case with all these guys. The Larry Craig's voting for the anti-gay amendments and, you know, stuff like that.
I mean, my sister has IM'd me, and she says that there is something called, in Sigmund Freud's psychoanalytic theory, called the reaction formation. It's a defense mechanism in which anxiety-producing or unacceptable emotions are replaced by their direct opposites. I mean, that's it, right? I mean, bingo. I mean, this is what the very foundations of the Republican Party or the conservative movement are built upon, is this sort of like they can't deal with their own self-loathing, so they basically turn that hatred outward upon projections of what they are on the inside.
That's entirely correct. Great to bring Freud into it. I think of, you know, psychologists, sociologists have talked about it, and, you know, I think about from studies, there's a great historian of the 20th century, Richard Hofstadter, that wrote a book, The Paranoid Style, you know, in American politics. And you look at the right, you know, and how in the 60s even with the Goldwater movement and some of the others, you had this far-right paranoid style. And right there in the opening part of it, he talked about this sort of projection of one's own sexual impulses onto the other, you know, those that they chose to hate and form against. And that was part of this whole paranoid mindset that we've seen come in where, you know, all liberals are evil or all communists are evil or all, you know, whatever it may be that they hate that week. And so it's the same thing with their own sexual impulses. You know, they need to define themselves by hating what it is that they wish they could be doing, I suppose.
It's just bizarre, and I enjoy your coverage of this, your blog,
no
at Brave New Films. I mean, somebody's got to do it, right?
Well, yeah, they do, you know. I mean, I like to think I'm not, you know, that I do a variety of things when it comes to trying to battle those on the other side, but this is one of those where I think it's an anthropological experiment that's interesting, and at the same time, it lets us laugh at them for their hypocrisy and how ridiculous they are, so... You know,
well,
it does a little bit of both.
I have to say that FUBAR,
America's right-wing nightmare,
was criticized by Publishers Weekly for dedicating over 40 pages to anti-gay Republicans. But I have a feeling that you could do volumes and volumes on it.
Probably could, yeah, and. One of the reasons that FUBAR was so good. And that I recommend everyone buy it.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. All right, well, look, we got to go. Cliff Schechter at bravenewfilms.com or org?
Org would be the one.
All right, and check out Cliff's blog there. And check him out when he does his GOP sexcapades every week on the Young Turks. Thank you so much for joining us, Cliff.
All right. Thanks a lot, man. Have a good night, Sam.
All right. We got to take a break. 800-989-1480. I will get to your calls. Michael, I will get to you. Lily, Claudia, Kevin, Kirk. I will get to all of you guys right after this. We are back, Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy for the rest of this week, ladies and gentlemen. Numbers 800-989-1480. We are streaming live at NovaAmRadio.com. Sammy Cam is at SamCedarShow.com. Let's go to Michael in San Antonio. Michael, how are you?
Good. How are you doing tonight? I want to thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling, sir.
Yeah, I was calling about the last caller you had on the show there.
He was
complaining about the cost of health care and the price of his water and his garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I only pay $50 a month, so I don't know where he lives where he pays $200 a month for his water and his trash. Mm-hmm. And we pay $250 a month for a family of four for our health coverage, and it's excellent coverage. So if he's paying $14,000 a year.
You pay $200, Michael. You pay $250 a month for your health care. Do you get that through your employer?
Yes, and it's full coverage for me and my family. Excellent coverage. We're paying $400 a month through my wife's job. And then when I started working at my new job, our insurance was basically cut in half.
$250 a month is very cheap for health care. You got a great employer.
I know. I work for a major cable company, and it's an excellent place to work, excellent benefits.
Now,
so
Michael,
if anybody's paying way too much, they can always find a better job with better benefits.
Really? They can always do that?
I mean, sure.
I mean, how many job openings are at the company you work at right now?
There's a lot of openings.
Really?
Yes, there
so
is.
So we should all move
to San
Antonio.
Work. No, you
so
have to be willing to work.
So, Michael, you're suggesting that the reason why people pay a lot for their health care at bad jobs is because they don't like to work.
No, I'm suggesting that if the company you're working for doesn't provide you benefits or doesn't provide you the benefits that you need for your family, look for a better position. They are out there.
They are out there, really.
I understand that health care is out of control. The cost of health care is out of control for a lot of people, but you can get good deals out there.
Well, I mean, let me ask you this, Michael. Are you aware that on a per capita basis, okay, we pay for health care in this country over 50% more than the next, any next Western industrialized country? You're aware of that, right?
Well, we also have the best health care system in the world.
Well, no, wait
and
a second. Wait a second. Michael, let me ask you a question. How are you basing that? When you say we have the best healthcare system in the world, are you basing that on life expectancy?
Well, I'm diabetic. If I need to go for a checkup, I don't have to wait 6 months for a doctor's appointment. I can get in next week.
Well, how do you know, Michael? What country are you talking about where you got to wait 6 months?
Canada, England. People die waiting on surgery.
Really? Now, you know this.
If we have socialized healthcare, where are the Canadians going to go to get their healthcare?
You know,
why
that's funny, Michael. You know what, Michael? I'll tell you something. You know what's fascinating to me? I heard that joke today on right-wing radio.
Yeah, that's our talking point. You know that, right?
Yes. I mean,
that's
you're spotting because
point.
Have you ever been to England?
No, I've never been to England.
You've been to Canada, of course.
Yeah, I've visited Canada, yes.
How many times?
Just once.
Just once? And who was the person you talked to that waited for 6 months for the health care?
I don't know anybody personally, but...
Okay,
I mean,
so, Michael, you're basing everything you're telling me on what someone has fed into your mind on the radio today. But when I tell you that we are ranked 14th in life expectancy, we're ranked down around 17, 18, 19, or 20, I think, in terms of infant mortality, and every single measure, in terms of statistics, we pay more for health care and we have worse health. Now, how do you explain that?
Well, I really can't explain that other than the fact that just look at the average American, you know, we don't exercise, we overeat, we don't really take care of ourselves. So, I mean, that could be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you need health care in this country, you can go into any emergency room and be treated.
Well, first of all, that's
you
not
can pay
true.
For
but Mike,
no,
Michael, Michael,
man,
let me ask
they
you a
have
question.
To treat
Michael,
you.
That's not true, actually. You're talking about public
hospitals. My wife's a nurse.
In public hospitals.
Any hospital.
Public hospitals only. But, Michael, when that happens, how much more expensive is it than it would be?
It's a lot more expensive, yeah.
So that's rather inefficient, don't you agree?
It is. We definitely do need reform in this country, but we do not need government health care.
All right. Well, what is the reform then, buddy?
I don't know. I don't have all the answers. I just know that. Look at the.
Loud was the voice of the lonely goat herd. Lay, lay,
thank you, Michael. Thanks for joining us. Oh, that's right. Don't know much about that French I took. I do know that Rush told me to say that joke about Canada. Actually, I think I heard that on Hannity yesterday. All right, we're going to take a break. 800-989-1480. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. So we got some comments coming in. Clea Tootie says, you pick a job for a health plan? Who does that? Actually, I know a lot of people who stay in their job because they're afraid of losing their health care. I know one of the reasons why I was excited to maintain a position on Sundays on my radio gig was to keep getting my union-backed health care. Yes, we will, it's called the Golden Handcuffs. Don from, Finland says that, he lives in Europe and he can go to the doctor the same day. He pays $15, gets all his meds at a reduced cost. $15 and you are in Finland. Done. No strings attached. Here we have two systems. Well, three. Private, which will, you'll see you immediately. Social, which will see you the same day, and the third that will assess your situation and decide when you get in. You can be seen the same day. Babies and children have top priority over all but most extreme cases, which would be a naturally emergency room situation. I got news for you, folks. I split my time between upstate rural community in a town that has 35 farms and down in New York City. My doctor in New York City cannot see me until November. My upstate doctor, trying to get in, first appointment, cannot see me for a month and a half out from today. Mew2C says it's a misnomer to say anything about a U.S. healthcare system. We have no healthcare system. That's right, we have none. Unbelievable. Tim in San Diego, listening on KLSD. Welcome to the program.
Another great show, Sam.
Thanks, Tim.
Yeah, you're welcome. I just wanted to say that, I mean, I don't wish ill health on anyone, but that fellow who called in, that self-righteous person, God help him if he and his wife simultaneously lose their jobs. He finds himself in this economy looking for work with a quote-unquote pre-existing condition. You know, it's almost like, what part of corporate welfare don't you understand, you stupid, lazy Republican voters?
Well, look, here's a guy who is literally regurgitating to me a line I heard on Sean Hannity's show yesterday. Word for
right.
word. Word for word.
Yeah.
He's talking about long lines in England and Canada. He doesn't know anything about what he's talking about. He heard Sean Hannity say it to him, and so he regurgitates it. He's got his, and he could give F all about everybody else.
That's right.
I mean, that's the one thing that is actually genuine in what he was saying. It's the one. It's the one thing that is actually true in his ideology.
You're right, Sam.
And he's just hoping it never happens to him. I got a good job, everybody else can get a good job. Well, I'll tell you what. From my perspective, this guy's a loser, and I'll tell you why, Tim. Because I know I've always made more money than him. And if I can do it, why isn't he doing it? Is it because he's lazy? I mean, or is he an idiot? He's just lazy. If he doesn't have the money that I have...
It almost sounds like he's qualified to be president of the United States, doesn't it?
Well, bingo. I appreciate the call, Tim. I mean, that's basically it. I mean, that's his argument, right? If somebody out there is actually having to pay more for health insurance because they don't have as good a job as me, they're not working hard enough. Well, then I tell that guy, hey, I work one day a week. And you know why I do? Because you're lazy. I mean, the worldview of these people is so narrow. So narrow. Let's go to Lily in Colorado Springs. Welcome to the program, Lily.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, my husband and I'm a PhD clinical psychologist, and my husband and I have a bed and breakfast, so we have two businesses, and we pay $805 a month between the two of us for health insurance.
Well, you must be very, very lazy, Lily.
We're very lazy, and we have a $5,000 deductible. So we're both very healthy, and we never hit the deductible, so it's basically, you know, extortion, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also work in healthcare on the other flip side of the coin, where I mostly have a specialty in geriatrics, and that's why I was calling, but there's been too much stirred up in between. But I do almost all Medicare, and it is a government-sponsored health insurance program. It's not socialized medicine.
That's right.
And
now, wait a second. We should tell people what the difference is. The difference is that if it was a government-socialized medicine, what it would be is that you would be an employee of the government.
Right.
But you're not.
I'm a private contractor with Medicare.
And you get paid by the government. But you do not work for the government.
Exactly.
They are your client in this case, or at least they are coming in the door with your clients and basically providing them health insurance of some sorts.
Exactly. And my fee is, I could charge $1 million an hour, but I get what I contract with them. And so I agree to their, you know, payment schedule.
Right.
Which is less than my hourly, but I make a good living.
Well,
and
then,
I don't know who's worth what most professionals think they're worth, but I make a good living.
Well,
and a lot of my colleagues who don't do Medicare make a killing. But
well, I mean, listen, that is, you know, you're obviously really lazy.
Oh, I'm very lazy. you ought to tag around with me.
Well, listen, Lily, go ahead.
The other thing is that do you need to go?
No. Do you need to go?
No. Okay. I didn't know. But Medicare's overhead is 3%.
Yes.
And I sometimes do the commercial health insurance, and I have to nag them so much to pay me. And their overhead is 30% because they're paying people not to pay me.
Well, exactly. That is the dirty little secret, that in this instance, the free market, so to speak, is dramatically less efficient than Medicare.
Absolutely.
I appreciate
it. And, you know, honestly, they have audited me twice just because they do routine audits, and I have absolutely every time provided them what they want, and I'm legit. I do memory disorders, so it's kind of funny because I have patients who forget they saw me.
Oh, well, that's hard to explain to the Medicare people, I would assume.
Well, basically, it sort of stops the patients. I say, oh, you can come and see, I have a file on you. But, you know, this isn't why I called. It's just evolved into this. I'm really afraid George Bush is dementing.
Well, listen, I've been afraid of that for a long time, and that's the only reason why I watch him when he gets on TV, because I want to see him.
Me too.
But, you know, Lily, it's, you know, I think he's been demented from the very beginning, and I think he's surrounded by demented people, and in some way the entire country is suffering some form of dementia. But I got to move on, Lily. I appreciate the phone
call. Okay.
I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't know if I actually will talk to you soon, but... I had that feeling. Lily, I could see why Lily is a great therapist. I felt very comfortable talking to Lily. Let's go to Steve in Miami, Florida. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Yeah, good evening, Sam. You know, I'm really sick and tired of hearing the people talking about a lot of things that they don't know. I mean, I live in the U.S. for 21 years, but I'm born in Canada, and my brother is a surgeon in Canada, so I know exactly the system in Canada. And I have to admit, it is true if you are a millionaire, you know, then you can have like a top care here in the U.S. with all the private and private nurse and private doctor and everything you want with a lot of money. But in general, I talk about in general, the regular people, the working class people are 10 times better in Canada health talking than here in the U.S. And don't make me wrong, Sam. I love my country is the U.S. now. I mean, I'm a full U.S. citizen. And I don't say that to blame the system in the U.S. I just say that to have the people stop talking about like if the system, the health system in Canada is from a third world country, you know? I mean, I understand, you know, Mr. Moore, when he make his film and he compare like the system in Cuba, that was not exactly true. You know, you don't have the same system in Cuba than in Canada, you know?
No, not at all.
You know, I mean, you have to make the difference. If you talk about Africa or something, it is different. But you know, you have when a doctor is a doctor in Canada, and if he wants to move in the U.S., he just have to pass the paper to change the country. He don't have to go back to the medical school. They are the same doctor. It's just the system, the paying system. And I'm really, Sam, I am sick and tired of hearing saying that you have to wait and you have to wait. Yes, it is true. You have maybe to wait a little bit longer than here.
Well, Steve, listen, I got news for you. I got to wait here, too. You know, there are times when you can go in and get your doctor immediately, but there are other times where you have to wait.
Exactly. You know, and when people, they talk like if you have an arm cut in half, then it's an emergency, then you have to wait 6 months for your x-ray and to see the doctor. This is bull, Sam. I mean, you are treated very, very well.
Well,
and
Steve, listen, I gotta go, but I appreciate the call. Of course. But if Sean Hannity says you got to wait 6 months in Canada, then this guy's like, all right, you got to wait 6 months in Canada. And if somebody doesn't have as good a job as he does in healthcare, then they're lazy. I don't know what is more of a concise, beautiful picture of the conservative mind than that caller. We're going to take a break. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy, 800-989-1480. Ward, I'll get you on the other side. We are back. Sam Cedar in for Mike Malloy. Ward calling from Kashima, Japan. Did I say that right?
Yes, Kashima.
Kashima. Thank you for holding.
Oh, thank you, Sam. You're doing a great job. I'm really glad you're sitting in for Mike.
Well, thank you very much.
That conservative guy that called in slipped something in there that isn't true. One of the things he said was he kept calling single-payer national health care. And single-payer is not national health care. Single-payer just means the government handles the insurance. And here in Japan, we have private medical care. but a nationalized insurance system. So it's single payer, but not nationalized health care.
Exactly.
It's really,
I mean,
excellent.
That's essentially what Medicare is. We do have socialized medicine in this country. It is called the VA.
Right.
The Veterans Administration actually has their own set of doctors and their own hospitals and whatnot. That is different from Medicare. Medicare simply just pays the bills.
Yeah.
Well,
we pay about $140 a month for the two of us. My wife's employer, which is the city, she's a school teacher, pays a portion. And I have had need of it a few times. And a visit to the doctor cost me about $4. And prescription medications are cheaper than over-the-counter meds.
Wow.
So it works.
Well, Ward, all I can tell you is that you've made that that conservative caller look incredibly lazy. In fact,
absolutely,
all of Japan makes this man look incredibly lazy because they have much better health care than he does.
Yeah, and actually, you know, if he weren't so lazy, he could come to Japan and get a job here.
Exactly. Well, Ward, I appreciate the phone call.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
It's interesting. I had no idea about Japan. I'm going to go to Kirk very quickly in Worcester, Mass. Kirk, what's up?
Hey, Sam. Well, I wanted to talk to you about what you said about Ron Paul and our country's the sovereignty thing.
Right.
Well, he is correct about sovereignty being in jeopardy. I think he's wrong about the UN being the problem. It's the third phase of our free trade agreements, the NAFTA superhighway.
Kirk, let me stop you right here. Okay,
yeah.
I know you were on hold for a long time. We don't
yeah.
have much time. I saw you wanted to talk about the NAFTA superhighway.
Yeah.
There is no NAFTA superhighway.
It has been talked about by Colonel Bob Bowman, who worked for the Carter and the Ford administrations as well.
That's fine, but I want you to look up Christopher Hayes, Nation Magazine.
I have read Christopher Hayes' article, and I felt like I was listening to Alan Colmes. It sound right. He is so wrong.
Well, all right, Kirk. I mean, listen, buddy.
I don't support Ron Paul. I'm not going to vote for him, but this issue, I do agree with him.
Well, listen, I mean, I think, you know, to the extent that they're letting in Mexican trucks.
Exactly.
Yes, that is, if you want to call that the NAFTA superhighway, then yes, that's happening. But there is no actual super highway that's going to be built. But I don't know what to tell you, but I do appreciate the call. And, I understand the concern here, but there is no NAFTA super highway that's going to be built. If you want to say metaphorically speaking, because I've already started to let in Mexican trucks, I can see your point, but There is no NAFTA superhighway. I'm sorry. Kevin in Washington, D.C., welcome to the program.
Yeah, I just want to point out, like, John Edwards' program, I think, is a good idea because you got to understand this country. We can only take progress in little drips. And basically, he wants to expand Medicare to put all the other companies out of business. So eventually, everyone will be on Medicare and won't have that stigma to it.
That's certainly what, you know, Krugman says, is that, you know, it's basically allowing for some competition between a version of an extended Medicare and private insurance, and let the marketplace decide in that case. And,
yeah, and
I think you're right about this, Kevin. I mean, I actually do. I mean, I think, like, you know, it would be great if we could snap our fingers and tomorrow we have a single-payer system, Medicare for all, but there are certain political realities that just doesn't make it possible because you got morons like that guy calling me up, telling me.
Well, for that guy, let me say how much this country's shooting itself in the foot by not adopting a single-payer plan. About a year or two ago, Toyota wanted to build a huge plant, and okay, all these states competed, and out of all the states, a place in rural Alabama got, you know, won the plant. And then what ended up happening is, you know, Alabama gave them the land and gave them all these sort of tax incentives. You know what they did, like a day before they finalized the agreement?
What?
Said, we're going up to Canada. It's cheaper because of the health care costs.
Yep. There you have it, Kevin. I appreciate the phone call, buddy. You're absolutely right. Look, you know, we just had these two strikes. And if I don't understand for the life of me why GM isn't the first person in line advocating for a single-payer system in this country. I don't understand it. Ladies and gentlemen, all too short, but tomorrow night is another night. I think it's specifically it's Thursday night. So please join us then. Thank you for joining us tonight. Billy, Ian, back in Phoenix. Lauren, back in New York. Thank you so much. Everybody on the Sammy Cam, callers. We'll see you tomorrow night. Thank you, Mike. NoVam Radio.